Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Schenkelberg.
And this is Carl Carlson.
Hey, Carl. I want to use that analogy of, you know, digging into the mailbag, but it isn't the same when it's an email.
That's right. No bag.
Yeah, just a list. So you mentioned just before we hit record, it was one of those, let's not talk about it until we hit record. It sounded like a good topic.
Yeah, I got a question. We get regular, you and I, and I'm sure the other contributors get regular questions from readers and listeners. And this one had to do with what he calls platform reliability, and where there's a lumping together, leveraging of the best common components and subsystems to improve reliability, to improve return on investments. And the question basically was, how does that compare to other types of reliability approaches? And I thought, what an interesting question. And I've certainly got experience on that, and I just thought it'd be fun to chat about it and see where that goes.
Well, the concept of, you know, building a platform and then iterating on that is a common technique. I mean, HP certainly did that with many different product lines. The auto industry does it, the medical industry does it, and so on. And you get one core set of functions built, and then you can cost reduce it, then you can add feature sets to it, then you can, you know, do add-ons to it or see how the customers react to it, and then they say, hey, we want XYZ added to it, and then that becomes the next generation. But it's still based on the same framework or structure or whatever. Don't think it's an uncommon technique. And I like it for the reliability aspect of it. But I think what I saw it being used, it was for supply chain and for focusing the efforts of the engineering team. It was a lot of work to come up with a new platform, but then that platform would sustain product releases for the next 5 years, for example, and with a lot less overall engineering effort.
Yeah, I'll go back to my GM days, and then we can talk about some other product lines. But they called it the matrix system.
Sort of like the movie.
The Matrix. And some of it was like that too. So you could have a door system, and functionally, a door system has hinges and windows and lifts and you know, different functional areas. And those functional areas have bodies of knowledge and skilled people. But then you also have the Malibu, the Corvette, different car lines. Mm-hmm. And you'll be crisscrossing into door systems from the project, like Corvette. But you can also approach door systems purely from the functional area, like hinges,
right,
or hinging systems. And sometimes the same engineer is supporting both efforts. So you have the engineer half their time is working on hinging systems as a core skill, and the other half they're sitting in on the Corvette meetings or the Malibu meetings or Cadillac CTS. Mm-hmm. About the hinge application on that particular vehicle program. And it makes for a very interesting job for the release engineers, the design engineers, and the manufacturing engineers. The same type of platform can exist in manufacturing, where you have certain equipment, certain robot systems, certain types of certain stations. But then you have the project that they're supporting. So you have the same kind of matrix. And I don't know if they're still doing that, to be truthful. I sort of lost contact a couple of years ago from that. But it did make sense from a reliability standpoint. So my group of reliability engineers, some of them would be functional, So there'd be electrical systems and, you know, door systems, and they would immerse themselves functionally on reliability. And others, we would have a Corvette reliability engineer, a Malibu reliability engineer, and they would stay overall. And to be honest, their focus was different, because the project engineers at the Corvette level would end up more focused at a systems level and interfaces. And their basic day-to-day job was different than somebody that went out and worked on seats or engines or that type of thing. So it is a different approach.
Well, one of the advantages from what I see from a reliability part, I mean, I agree with you, there's different approaches, and it helps you get the coverage at the point where those kinds of decisions and discussions are taking place. At the Corvette level, there's looking at the system and integration and interfaces and all those things. So that's the place to have a person that's looking at those aspects of reliability. And the person working on seats that knows everything about Naugahyde, I don't even know if that's a real material, but what it does is it allows the systems to go, well, here's my menu, right? If I pick these three parts from these kinds of materials, I don't have to know more about it because we already do. And what I see the biggest advantage from a reliability point is if you do the due diligence and get the platform constructed that can serve for many years of generations of a product iteration, is now 80% of your product is known. Right. And even that platform, we pulled in known technologies like circuit boards and power supplies and buttons and things like that. We brought in known components and invented a few new things or explored new technologies to create a base for that platform. And it focused our work on what was new. From the designer's point of view, it was a larger team to create a new platform, because there was just more things to sort out and integrate and so on. And in some cases, it was one of my roles at HP was working with a inkjet printer team, and I worked with the electrical, the main motherboard electrical engineer. And Ed was, I don't have time to engineer every little iota out of this thing, so I'm going to over-engineer it. I'm going to put lots of parts on it to make sure it just works, right? His goal was to get the functionality of the core systems working. And he said, it gives the next generation of cost reduction something to do if I put too many capacitors on here.
Yes.
You know, kind of thing. And it was true. It was their priority was time to market of getting this new platform together. And they were under a lot of time pressure to get a good, solid platform. And they could refine it later. They knew they could refine it later. So it shaved big focuses away from the design team. From a reliability point of view, it was, that's a novel new idea. We don't know how it'll behave. Let's check that. Let's explore that. Let's experiment with that. And so it focused our work on the what we perceived as the highest risk areas of it. But we could go into depth on parts and characterize them. And then it would be work that would have value for the next 5 years, you know, because it was built into the platform and we didn't have to redo it. So there's lots and lots of reasons it's done. And I think from a reliability point of view, I like the matrix type of approach. I didn't have that luxury. We just had one reliability engineer for the entire program. We had a lot of support and the team did a lot of their own stuff, but it was really just a triage of what's the most risky parts. And let's focus on those.
Yeah, I think that's we have to at least acknowledge that the size of company makes a difference on that. If you're in a small startup, you don't have the luxury to have a functional area versus a project area from a reliability point of view, and you're going to be toggling back and forth. But there is, you mentioned an 80%, and I think it's worthwhile to understand that there's definitely a crossover. So mm-hmm. if you can work on platform, or call it functional reliability of the functional area, and there's a lot of crossover when you go to the project, but there are some differences. So I wanted to just highlight some of the differences. I think when you're working functionally, you can get even more into the failure mechanisms and the physics of failure, the science of failure. Like, for instance, if you were an engineer working on hinges, you're going to get more into the mechanics and the metallurgy and what have you of hinges from a reliability point of view than if you're working on a project at a higher level. And so that some of the tools you use as a reliability engineer might be different. An FMEA, you can do an FMEA in a functional area. So I'd call it a generic FMEA. Mm-hmm. Usually FMEAs are done at the project level where you're supporting a particular project that is heading towards a launch. System reliability modeling. So you'd have to think about, you can do a system reliability model on a functional area, like a door system. Oftentimes you're doing it on a project because if you remember, I have to say this to Fred, do you remember the definition of reliability? So the definition of reliability is that the item performs its intended function under the conditions of use and the operating profile to a certain level of probability. I mean, you've got these different elements in this definition.
Right.
And some of those come together on a project that don't necessarily come together functionally, because like a Corvette may have different loads than a Malibu.
Right.
And or an off-road vehicle may have different loads or environments. And so those loads come into the conditions of use that are part of the definition of reliability. So you really have to know the application to get deeply into the reliability functions. So there are differences between the functional area and the project level that I think an engineer should at least be aware of.
Well, there's one of the roles of many engineering teams is at some point they bring in more scientist types. And their job is to explore a new technology or explore a new manufacturing process or develop a new invention into a product-worthy device. And they may not know what the future stresses are. It may be just a concept, but they have the charge of saying, well, here's the range of stresses it can withstand. Here's where it can function well, and here's where it doesn't. And from a reliability point of view, when somebody comes up with a new novel item, you know how I am, Carl, is like, so how does it break? where are the limits? What can we do with this and not do with this? And so somebody comes up with a brand new IC, but it only works at, near absolute zero. Well, then we've got all these extra things to worry about of like, actually, how do we cool this and keep it cool all the time? That kind of stuff. And I agree with you. There's different focuses, but I think if you're the only reliability-minded person in your organization, you got to leverage all of those other engineers, whether they're materials or material scientists or electrical engineers or your suppliers or vendors, and approach it from all of those different levels. But the overall approach is, I like the matrix approach. I like the idea that you can, if you have the luxury of characterizing some new novel stuff before you put it into a product, that's one approach. We often don't get that luxury. It's, here's a new idea. Let's sell it next week. And then you go develop it.
Well, therein is another difference. And really, if you're one reliability engineer supporting the company, you're going to be toggling between functional areas and projects. And one of the differences is the product development process. Mm-hmm. And you're going to be when you're talking about the project, you're going through different gates, and then there's a timing issue that's more relevant than a purely functional area. And in the functional area, you're working on the science of the products and developing them, and then they get interspersed into or interwoven into the product development process. So the subject of design reviews become different. So you really have to do both, and a good reliability engineer understands both sides. But it's definitely helpful to reliability professionals to understand the organization you're working within and when you're working in support of a functional area versus a purely a project.
Well, I'm going to add a third slice to this, that kind of thinking of what part of the organization is the suppliers, the supply chain, the vendor management type stuff is there. It's a combination of the higher level setting expectations, working with the contracting, the component or vendor selection process, all that kind of stuff. And then there's the detailed part. Well, how well do they know their process and how stable is it? Because that information goes back to our tolerancing, you know, discussions, and because the variability in a supplied part, if it's not capable of hitting of the desired tolerances, that's a reliability problem. I mean, it's also a yield problem and all kinds of stuff. But the idea is that is another level that's complicated by contractual language between organizations.
Oh, it is. I'm gonna share a story, and I may have shared this before, but I think it's relevant to this conversation. And it's a topic of a future podcast, but who has responsibility for supplier reliability? ? Mm-hmm. And I remember back in the late 80s, I was working with a new engineering director that I reported to. And I asked that question because I knew that a lot of the problems we were seeing were inside supplier parts. And I would go and I say, well, okay, so where in the organization is the responsibility for supplier reliability? And he said he didn't know. Mm-hmm. So he and I walked up and down the boardroom, so to speak, the long hallway with executives.
And the nice carpet and plants that are alive and stuff like that.
Exactly. We sort of poke our head in and say, hello, we're from whatever. And we'd like to know if you have responsibility for supplier reliability. And they go, nope, not me. So we go down the next office, and we basically ended up empty-handed, that nobody seemed to have the responsibility for supplier reliability. We found supplier quality. Mm-hmm. We found all purchasing. And so we embarked on a program to understand or get roles and responsibilities defined around supplier reliability. And we ended up in purchasing. And so we basically sat in on the purchasing discussions so that we could be sure that the supplier who was selected had the capability to meet supplier reliability requirements. And then we began defining supplier reliability requirements so that they were as well defined as the internal reliability requirements. So I'm just basically saying it's not trivial. It's worth exploring. And because I've been in some companies on the consulting role, long since GM, and I say, well, that's a supplier reliability problem. And the company goes, well, that's not our job. At least I'm talking to the reliability engineers of the company.
Right. Well, it's the same problem you recognized at GM. I'm focusing on the decisions that we have control over. And it says, well, that's where the rub is that your nameplate's on this thing. The customer doesn't like it. They're going to think of it's your product. Yeah. And you're deciding which suppliers to use. It's a pretty bold assumption to think that all suppliers create perfect parts every time.
Not at all. And supplier quality looks at material incoming part. Does it meet the requirements at day one or hour one? And nobody seemed to be focusing on the reliability of the supplier parts. And now when I teach reliability management or consult on reliability management, I consistently say that you have to take responsibility for the critical parts to make sure that the supplier parts are reliable.
Yeah. And it's tough, though. It's because you've run into this where it's a supplier changes a formula for raw material. So it has different particle size, and it manifests 6 months after it's launched in your product.
Yeah.
You know, there are those bombs that come through the system. Yet I think it's the concept is if the culture is we want to know what's critical, and it might be a supply of raw material and then what we need to focus upstream. I've gone 3 or 4 steps up a supply chain to make sure that it was adequate and it was in control and all the other aspects of it and then understood. And because putting together something as simple as a multi-layer ceramic capacitor is incredibly complex when you get into the details. And the trouble is that the types of failures that can occur can get through all of the quality hoops with no problem and still be a problem.
Yeah, exactly, because they're reliability problems, so to speak.
Right.
And they don't show up on the quality tests or the quality inspections. So yeah, I think if as long as you focus on the vital few, in other words, in a reliability group, they don't typically have the resources to focus on all parts, reliability of all parts. And so you have to have some way to narrow down what's most critical. And then roll up your sleeves and get involved and make sure that the supplier make sure you have reliability requirements that the supplier has to adhere to, and then make sure that they meet them as part of the purchasing process. We baked that in on the Cadillac CTS into the purchasing agreements before it was first launched. We said that not only do you send us your parts, but you send us parts that meet for the critical parts, that meet our, the FMEA has been approved by us, and supplier reliability requirements are met for the vital few. Made a big difference.
So in short, the idea of a platform type of reliability approach, it is often because that's the way you're going about creating your products. You're using a platform base and then iterating that product over time. That's at least the way I interpret that phrasing. You know, you create a Corvette model or body, and then you change the trim on it for the next 3 years. I know you guys' tricks over there in Autoland. You know, but they have basically the same, you know, they have the same basic drivetrain and framework and all those kinds of things. And then you change the dashboard or add better Naga hide onto it or whatever. But I think there's lots of reasons. It's not just reliability reasons to do that kind of approach. There's lots of sound business reasons for doing it. But it does have some unique focus patterns that you described, Carl. And then it also allows us to put to bed areas that we have good, deep understanding of. If we know that part's good or that concept is solid and we have it well characterized, well, we don't have to revisit that until those boundaries get moved into those boundary areas where we have less knowledge about. But then I think the third part of supplier reliability is equally important as looking at the system, looking at the functional areas, as you were phrasing it. So I think, to me, there's those three main focuses that go into whether you're doing a platform, and frankly, whether you're doing platform or not, you got to cover all of those aspects.
That's a good summary, Fred.
All right. Well, I mean, it's one of those things that came from a question, and it was from Bart. Appreciate that. I know I see your name every now and then, and I know you've been pretty active on Ascendo. And so keep sending over the questions. If you've got a question or an idea or a concept that you'd like us to discuss, and plus we'll, as much quick as we can, we try to get reasonable answers out to you, or ideas or concepts or resources or whatever. Let us know. Head over to ascendoreliability.com/go/SOR, and you'll find a contact form there. Carl, I, and the rest of the hosts on the Speaking of Reliability podcast are also on LinkedIn, and or on, you can contact us directly through our about pages. I think every one of us has our email and contact forms there. So there shouldn't be any reason not to get in touch. And if you just want to say nice things, we appreciate that too. That's always good. So with that, Carl, I think we'll wrap that one up.
Thanks, Fred.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation if you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show. Please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.